call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time, we're always so precise, our committee is good. It's 3:15. The date is Friday, February 21st, 2003. Let the record also reflect that there is a quorum with Representatives Guttenberg, Crawford, Gatto, and myself, Chairman Anderson, and Representative Roper's on his way, I'm told, and Representatives Dahlstrom and Lynn are in Anchorage at a Military and Veterans Affairs ceremony and convey their good wishes. Today we have my bill, House Bill 91, regarding retired peace officers, COLA, and medical benefits. Next week's schedule, February 24th, is House Bill 10 by Representative Roper, Group Health Insurance for Private Groups. Wednesday, February 26th, is the Joint House and Senate Labor and Commerce meeting to review appointments to the RCA Board with Dave Harbor and Mark Johnson before us. And then Friday, February 28th, oh my gosh, we have about how many, Josh?
29
gubernatorial appointments that we have to listen. Many of them will not be here. It'll be fairly expedited, but recognize that so many of those boards and commissions we oversee in some way or another through labor and commerce activities.
It'd be at something in Anchorage, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
boy,
that's the truth. That's the truth. So we will get to my bill. The only bill before us today is House Bill 91. And House Bill 91, in my belief, is about equity in our state retirement system. House Bill 91 is also a vehicle through which retention of peace officers throughout our state will be increased. Essentially, the normal state employee retirement is 30 years, at which time medical benefits are immediately activated. But the normal peace officer retirement is 20 years, and medical benefits are not instantly activated. They're withheld until the person reaches 60 years old or works an additional 5 years. So this House bill essentially corrects the delay by allowing peace officers to receive their medical benefits upon normal retirement, just as other PERS recipients receive medical benefits upon their normal retirement. I think it provides parity between employee medical benefits, you know, obviously upon this retirement stage, and enhances retention levels. And we'll get to that. You can see some of these things which when Mr. Fox comes out to talk about those in the packet. Also, the bill addresses COLA, the Alaska Cost of Living Allowance for peace officers, and activates after 20 years. And by doing this, making this adjustment, retired peace officers will be given an incentive to remain in the state where they will continue to contribute to the public good. So in terms of people able to testify, I see Guy Bell, Director of Retirement and Benefits, but first we're going to hear Mike Fox. So if you could come up to the table, it looks like you're going to give a presentation. And for the record, if you could state your name and affiliation.
My name is Mike Fox, Michael J. Fox. People usually remember that. I am a lobbyist. But I don't think I'm your typical lobbyist, and I've never done this before. I'm a retired trooper living here in Juneau. And when the Troopers Union, PSEA, wanted to propose this legislation, they were looking for somebody to pitch their bill here in Juneau, and they called me up and asked me to do it. And told them I didn't know anything about it, and they said, well, we're happy to learn with you. So you'll have to put up with that. You're learning this right along with me. I was in the Fish and Wildlife Division of the Troopers for 22 years when I retired. I was living here in Juneau at that time, and that was in 2000. So I'm a Tier 1 retired trooper. And what we did here is basically put your packet on a new format. So if you wanted to keep track in your packet, you'll be able to see most of the stuff in there. It's not exactly the same as it is, so you might like it when it comes to the graph. We'll start flipping through this.
Why don't we take a brief at ease and have him check. Brief at ease. Action.
House Bill 91 is just what it says. It's an act relating to a cost of living allowance and medical benefits for retired peace officers after 20 years of service. Section 1 amends the statute to provide residency, COLA, at normal retirement.
You might want to speak into the microphone. Just can you hear him?
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Okay, good. Continue.
And it also amends the statute to provide medical benefits at normal retirement. This is who's affected by the bill. It's a definition in terms, peace officer, it's a retirement definition. A peace officer is further defined by regulation, and it just basically says police is what peace officer is. So if you're a firefighter, a chief of police, any of those people, you'd be affected by this bill. If you are non-tier one, which is kind of the deal there, there's 2021.
And just for the record, it states on the graph who is affected by this bill: peace officer, firefighter, chief of police, regional public safety officer, correctional superintendent, probation officer, and fire chief under the PERS and peace officer definition.
You said you were tier one?
Representative Yes. Otto.
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question. Is that the same in the Anchorage Fire Department as plan one?
Through the chair, if the person is in PERS and he was hired prior to 1986, they would probably call it tier one. I would expect that's the same. Maybe that's a good question for Guy Bell.
We'll get to that question when Mr. Bell comes, Representative Gatto.
This is a mission from PERS. It's right off their website on their mission statement. And the part we're mostly interested in is this highlighted part.
Could you read that for the record?
On January 1st, 1961, the Alaska Legislature established the Public Employees Retirement System, PERS, to attract and retain qualified people into public service employment. This is what we call Tier 1. And Tier 1 are people that were hired from that time, 1961, through June of 1986. And how our bill affects these two things. There's many more things that are in the retirement package, but our bill refers to the COLA and medical benefits. And it was very generous in those years. This bill, in 1986, by SCSCSHB 252 by Finance, was sponsored by Duncan and Miller. And that gave us Tier 2. And how Tier 2 affected COLA and medical is that COLA is payable after age 65 and major medical is provided at age 60. And it's also noteworthy that those benefits are available to disabled people, but we're not dealing with that in this bill. That bill was changed by House Bill 242 in 2001 by Representatives Cott, Stevens, Dyson, Cisna, Crawford, and Guest. And that brought us to today, which is the Alaska COLA is unchanged, still payable at 65 and if you're disabled. Major medical at age 60, normal retirement for all others at the time of normal retirement, and for peace officers, normal retirement after 5 additional years at work. House Bill 91 is what we propose. And the changes would be the underlined part in the top, which would be peace officers to receive COLA when they have normal retirement, 20 years. And it would eliminate that plus 5 years, be medical benefit at normal retirement.
Representative Gatto.
The statement, perspective, Alaska COLA is payable after age 65 for a peace officer, doesn't read like a sentence to me. I have no idea what that says.
Through the chair, the law says that Alaska COLA is now payable to benefit recipients age 65 and older. It would be that, or it'd be payable to peace officers at normal retirement.
And just to, for your edification, he's not quoting the bill verbatim. I think this is just
there's two conditions where it would be three. There's a disabled element also to that, but there's two. Would be if you're 65 and if you've been a peace officer at normal retirement, you put 20 years of service. Many of the issues deal with vestment, you know, a 5-year vestment, 10-year vestment for medical, that sort of thing. There's no independent investment category with this bill. It's if you work 20 years. It's not if you're vested and then somehow get to 20 years. You have to have 20 years of credit service.
And let the record reflect Representative Roper has joined the committee.
Just get rid of that for a second and refer to the fiscal note.
Members should have fiscal note for them.
We just received the fiscal note this morning. And if you look at the bottom of the fiscal note and the text at the bottom, it'll tell you that it's a $1.224 million fiscal note, and it'll be a 0.18% increase in the contribution by employers. And how that would play out, this graph shows you the contribution made by employers into PERS by fiscal year. Oops. 1990, fiscal year 1990, it was at a little above 12. Peaked up around 17 here and went down, and now this year it's 8.42.
Well, just for the record, you might want to distinguish so the, in terms of our record. So in 1994, it peaked.
1994 was up around 17%, and then it declined down through the 2003, and then it's back up to 8.42 in 04.
Okay.
So this fiscal note would impact that 8.42 to 8.60. It's a 0.18 would be the difference. And I did a little arithmetic this morning, and a person with a salary of $55,000 a year, 0.18% of that is $99. So it'd be $99 a year in cost to the employer.
Excuse me, if I could.
Representative Roper.
Yeah, on that point.
And Representative, Director Bell hasn't testified yet.
So. Okay. Well, you said employers. Is that all the employers that are part of the PERS system?
That would be all state employers, which is average 8.42. I don't have the numbers for all PERS employers.
Well, if there's PERS employers outside the state, I mean municipal governments and so forth.
Representative Roper, I think we'll have, because I don't know if Mr. Fox can answer that. He received the fiscal today, and I think that maybe Mr. Bell, do you want Mr. Bell to answer now?
Well, we can
now?
Wait if you want.
We'll wait.
We can wait for,
yeah,
on
you
a
can ask all kind of the technical finance questions for him. I think it might be easier. Go ahead. You can continue.
Our justification for change is that the current law undermines the intent of peace officers' normal retirement by denying a benefit unless an extra 5 years is worked. This inhibits recruitment, it lowers morale, and it inhibits retention. This graph is a percentage graph. The blue section on the bottom.
And just for the record, if you want to follow along and you can't read that on the screen, we do have the attachment in your book here, and it's in color. It shows pretty thoroughly.
This graph shows turnover by using the percentage of troopers by year who are still working compared to those who separated or promoted into administrative positions. For example, the 12-year class, these guys here are right at 50%. So what you're looking at is 50% of those guys are still working and 50% of them are gone. And you can see that years 1 through 8 is pretty steady. And then we start seeing a decline and retention at about year 9, 10 through here. These years are blank because and the state trooper, they didn't hire anybody in those years. So there is nobody in that year class. You can see at 21 years, there's only like half a dozen people left.
But that's because of retirement.
Right. Okay. They've separated. This graph is it shows the number of troopers by year class. This is not percentage, this is numbers. And this is less than 5 years, this is 5 to 10 years. So from 10 years back, there's 275 troopers or 237 troopers out of 315 total. So 75% of the field level troopers, this is troopers, corporal, sergeants, the field level people, 75% of them have less than 10 years on the job. And there's a dramatic drop off to 10 to 15 years.
And so from Representative Anderson, the question would be then that you believe, Public Safety Employees Association believes that the majority of these separations is due to transfers to other agencies, whether they be federal or local, or going to the private sector, or simply leaving law enforcement completely, and is attributed to a majority attributed to the benefits, and that they're, whether it be COLA or medical or both, and they're finding, is that correct?
Well, Chairman Anderson, you know, we put a lot of thought into this and talked to a lot of troopers, and both retired and working, and what we're finding is that I expected going into this that we'd see a lot of dropout early, like in the first 5 years, and that's really not what we found. We found that the younger people were pretty enthusiastic still about their jobs. A lot of them didn't even know what their retirement benefits were. What ended up happening is they get up to the 8, 9, 10-year group, and they start looking into their future. A lot of them are in their early 30s. A lot of them are very well trained and educated. They're very good employees. And the other job opportunities come along, and they look at the future, and they say, can I stay in this for 15 more years to get my full retirement? Can I go 25 years in this business to get my retirement? And we're finding that a lot of them, the answer is no. They're happy for the first 5 years. They're enthusiastic. You know, they're into the program. And then as time wears down, they realize, geez, I've done this for 10 years now. Can I do it for 15 more? And more, the answer is coming up, no, I can't.
And I would supplement that question with one more. Thank you for your response. And the question being, first, a comment that a lot of law enforcement offices, and there's the record of that correspondence in the packet and more coming, a lot of law enforcement agencies have said, we tied in with this, agree, and personnel have contacted me, and they said, we agree, and I've asked them many times, and I just want you to agree with this or not, in terms of your assessment, that like a peace officer, a fireman, Carl, Representative Gatto, and I were looking at the delineation of what a peace officer is, but normally we think of a law enforcement officer, policeman, and there's a larger or a bigger burnout rate, is there not, than a regular state employee? Oh, so, I mean, we're comparing apples to oranges in a sense.
Chairman Anderson, that's the purpose for a 20-year retirement. That's the difference. I think it's a wise choice. It's common in federal government, it's common with other states, that 20 years is a standard retirement time for peace officers and firemen. And, you know, I tried to actually talk to guys and get an answer, so to put a number on this thing. So I started calling troopers, and I asked them, so what's the probability that you're going to be working for 20 years, that you're going to be in this career for 20 years? And I went down this list, and I just started asking them that question. Then what would be the probability that you would continue this career if the benefit was changed to where you got everything at 20? And it was consistent. There would be an improvement, certainly an improvement. And I can read them to you, I think. We would, 50% was a common response, that there's a 50% probability that they make it to 20. And then an 80-90% probability that they would make it to 20 if the benefit was changed. The last person that I talked to was a trooper in Ketchikan, and he told me, his statement to me was, it would clear up a lot of room on my hard drive. Mm-hmm. And I followed up with that, why? What's up with that? And he said, well, it's full of job offers. His home computer was full of prospective employers because he was a pilot. He was a helicopter pilot. And he was in his early 30s, and he's got a wife, and he's got kids, and he's looking down the road. He had 4 years on, and he said, can I keep doing this for 21 years? And the answer is no. He can't stay for 21 more years, and you have a 25-year retirement.
And this is where the COLA and the medical benefits might have encouraged him to stay.
So then I asked him, you know, what would it be if it's 50% without this, what would it be if we change it? And he said, His answer was 99%. I said, well, I can't have it. I got to have it in groups of 10. And he said, well, then, he said 100% is what he said. Because he felt that if he worked another, another 16 years, that he'd be able to take care of his wife and kids the way he wanted to and retire at 20. Otherwise, he was a gone Johnson. He wasn't going to do it. And that was a pretty typical response. But I also found that the core people with those kind of responses were the guys that had between 3 and 6 and 8 and 9 years. The younger guys were much more optimistic. They would say 60-70% chance that they would make it. The older guys, 13 years and beyond, they were the same. They'd say there's a 70-60-70, maybe 80% chance they'd make it. And then 100% chance that they got this back. So the dropout rate, where the people have second thoughts on careers, is in between that. It's not the new excited guys, and it's not the older guys. It's the in-between guys.
Thank you, Francis. Why don't you, unless there's not questions on that graph, why don't you then go to the next so we can drive around. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious. Suppose this was for a group of school teachers or custodians or a group of ferry workers. Would they all say the same thing? I can't do this job for that much longer. I'll have to leave. Or is it specific that you have to be in public safety to get that feeling?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, having not answered that question, I'll just guess. And I have two relatives, a sister and a sister-in-law, that are school teachers. And I would suspect that their answers would be about the same. They have a really loaded job. They get summers off, which I think saves them from as much stress maybe as they'd otherwise have if they had to work 12 months out of the year. But my sister and sister-in-law are highly dedicated teachers, and I know that they bring a burden home every night that might have the same results if asked those same questions. On the other hand, public employees that run the whole range from a low-stress job, maybe the DOT or the ferries, I couldn't answer that. They have a 30-year retirement. If you said you had to work 35 years, I just couldn't guess if that would change their mind or not. I can speak to police officers and a little bit to teachers.
Thanks. Why don't you continue that?
Of course, everyone's concerned with money, so we tried to look at some costs that would be associated with recruitment training, and this goes directly to retention. Because our position is, if you can retain some of those guys 6 and 8 and 10 years, you can retain them to 20, then you get more back on your dollar. And some of those costs include the recruitment would be written testing, oral and written psychiatric exams with psychologists. There's a polygraph exam. Those are all one-on-one things. There's a physical agility and fitness testing. There's physical health examinations and drug testing. There's extensive background investigations, and there's applicant review board. I just did this out of my memory. There's probably more stuff, but all those things have cost attached to them for recruiting. Training is pretty much standard. There's a basic academy for most of them. There's a field training period for most of them, and there's very often specialized training. The specialized training can have a large impact on firefighters and policemen both. Very often there's, for example, with policemen, there's a lot of equipment kind of things like pilots, helicopter pilots, boats, and there's all sorts of things like handling bombs and canine and hazmat and all that stuff. So in the absence of numbers for you, which have not been forthcoming, I can just tell you that all this stuff costs money, and when you lose a person, you lose all the money that you've invested in that.
You understand, just for the committee to understand, first of all, the Department of Public Safety is in transition with Commissioner Tandesky just taking office several weeks ago, but we did request this about a month ago, and he's notified me today at the Judiciary Committee that he would expedite that cost. And this is obviously relevant to the bill, because the point of the bill is we're losing people who are trained and who have gone through not only with work experience, but through expensive training experience. And as they depart, as Mr. Fox has alluded to, by the middle of their potential tenure, it's costing us a lot of money. And it's easy to look at the fiscal note, especially in a time of cost cutting, and say, whoa, you know, we're trying to cut this year, not increase. But in relation to the amount of people leaving service for other jobs as noted or for better benefits, this may be a wash or even money savings, and I think that information will be critical once hopefully this passes out today and goes to the finance, and by then they'll have that so they can assess just how much we're saving by keeping these troopers and peace officers.
There's an argument that if 20 is good, then 25 is better. And you know, the way I try to make sense of this is, well, if 25 is good, then 30 is better, and 30 is good, then 35 is better, and you have to draw the line somewhere. And the standard is 20 years. It's the standard in federal government law enforcement. It's the standard in other states. It's 20 years, and there's a good reason for that. As you age in your job, first you're compensated at a much higher rate. You have increased health problems, you have increased risk of injury, and you have a low morale and a burnout factor. And all these are pretty well documented at human resources. And a lot of it starts happening after the 20-year period. One of the problems with police officers in their careers, this graph shows you the administration versus officer positions. In a lot of careers, you can move from the rough and tumble section into the desk section. And that really is a pretty limited option for most peace officers. You can see in the top one, that's corrections. It's the Department of Corrections. And all these guys are COs that work on the floor of the jail. 709 of them. 30 that work in administration. All these people qualify as peace officers, but only 30 of them have jobs that are not associated with being on the floor, I mean directly on the floor working. And I don't know how many of you guys have had an opportunity to spend time on the floor of a jail. It's a tough place to spend 25 years.
And so again, you're delineating that we're talking on peace officers, which could include what Representative Gatto was, which was a fireman and a medic in the PERS system, or policeman, or fish and wildlife officer, or correctional officer, and it appears like correctional officers will be most served by this.
There's 709 of them on the floor, yes. The next one is fish and wildlife troopers. That's the group that I was in. And there's 82 that are troopers and sergeants, the worker bees, and there's 2 that are administrators. Actually, there's, in that division right now, there's eight positions, but they're not all filled. There's actually about 5. They're filled, but they had the position, so I put them in. With the troopers, it's 214 to 25. So when we talk about leaving the workforce, you're leaving up into administration and leaving completely, that's what your choice is. Moving on to the COLA, this is a pretty simple concept, the benefits of the Alaska COLA. We would just say that retired peace officers, their experience and training allow them to be positive influences in society. They continue to fill important roles in service to their neighbors, communities, and state. They often work in security positions protecting public and private interests, and they frequently become involved in public service and volunteer activities. In conclusion, we'd say that the current law undermines the intent of normal retirement for peace officers, inhibits PERS mission to recruit and retain peace officers in public service. And we would say that HB 91 restores a true 20-year retirement for peace officers.
Great, thank you. Well, do we have any questions then after that nice presentation? And all of it is in hard copy in your bill packet. I'll switch back to the chair. Are there any questions for Mr. Fox? And then we'll get to testimony by Mr. Bell. Representative Roper?
Yeah.
Mike Fox?
Yes, sir.
I was struck by the your last statement about the COLA. Why is it that peace officers and no other employees that retire prior to 65, why should peace officers be a special category and get a COLA, but nobody else gets one?
Through the chair.
Prior to 65.
Through the chair, Ms. Roper, I'd be delighted if everyone received the Alaska COLA. However, this is a peace officer bill that was sponsored by peace officers, and they're paying me to come here and pitch it for peace officers. Yeah, and if there was going to be an amendment to include all public servants, it would certainly wouldn't bother me.
Let me supplement that with another question. Isn't it true that whether it be a fireman or a police officer with training, medical training in terms of emergency medical services training, or simply a record in terms of record of law abiding in the elements that come with a peace officer, isn't also the mentality not that they're better or more important, but that we would like to maintain these people in Alaska and not have them move out of state?
Chairman Anderson, it could be, I could respond as a question of value. Peace officers, which include firefighters and EMTs and policemen, they receive a lot of good training. They receive a lot of good experience in their employment. And I would say much more so than many other professions that are in PERS. There is a significant value of keeping that in Alaska. There is a significant value when we have, for example, the oil pipeline and the oil terminal and the oil fields to protect from security issues. And the people that come to work there in generally passive assignments, not rough and tumble police assignments, it's very valuable to have this group of peace officers available to take those jobs.
Representative Roper has a follow-up, but I would also add that I'll bet there are numerous of these that we've referenced that are in the Guard as well, Air Guard and National Guard, which is an element of that we don't want them to leave those services. Mm-hmm. Representative Roper.
Well, Chairman, I think, Fox, correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding, and maybe I can also ask this to Mr. Bell when he gives his testimony, that the rationale for a COLA allowance, number one, was to create an incentive for the former state employees to stay in the state or to at least recognize that the cost of living in Alaska, if they do reside there, is somewhat higher. Secondly, I think there's a recognition here because clearly in the statute it says that you have to be 65 years of age or older to qualify for a COLA. The idea being, I think, presumably, that this additional benefit should only go to those people who are, in fact, actually retired, not people that are looking to go into another profession. Because when you're retired, you're limited to your ability to work and make additional income. Therefore, the idea of a COLA is to make sure that you have sufficient means in which to clearly anybody that retires after 20 years is going to be, I think, more often than not, maybe you know the answer to the question, how many of these people are going to go into other work?
Through the chair, Ms. Roper, try to get all these questions and I can remember them all. First, I would say that in response to helping you get by when you're actually in a true retirement mode, I can see that that's a valid point. My point is one of retention. These people are taking their skills somewhere. If they're going to work, they're going to work somewhere. They're going to work here or they're going to work in another state if they're going to work. And my position is it'd be good for the state to retain those people here and put them to work here. If they're just going to be retired, they're going to take their retirement checks somewhere. They're going to take them to another state or they're going to take them here. And once again, I think it's good to keep them here and keep their money here. My own self, I worked very little since I retired. And my objective at the time of retirement was to spend more time with my children. That was specifically why I retired. And I had kids moving out of the house and going to college. I was gone pretty much their whole lives working. And that was the significant factor in my decision to retire. And the 10% made it possible for me to actually retire and not work very much for 2 years and spend that time filling in for my wife. And I was able to do that because of the retirement benefits that I received. Now that my kids are getting a little older, I'm trying to work a little bit more. So if you want to use me, for example, it definitely provides an incentive for me to stay here and to pursue that lifestyle. It allows me to be a soccer coach and a baseball coach and all the things that I do with my kids. Now, if that's not valid in your mind, then it's not. It is valid in mine. And another, let's see, what was your last one? I can't remember.
You were comparing to the age.
Well, I mean,
you said that 65 and this reduces.
Right. I get. I think you're trying to make the case, as I take it, Mr. Fox, that because of this special category of people have some special extra talents that we should pay them some special extra money. I don't understand this at all. Because this is supposed to be, I think, for people that are truly retired. Well, my question was, do you know how many people that would be under this category actually go on to other work or something? Because there's the phenomenon of double, triple, or quadruple dipping type thing that people do different retirement programs in different areas, therefore they can get multiple retirements. So presumably if you have a peace officer that, say, goes to work at age 25 or something, and the 20-year recommendation here of this bill is that they would retire from the peace officer at 45. I think that more often than not, the vast majority of those folks would go on to other work or still be in the workforce, but not truly retired. So, I mean, do you have any idea what percentage go on to other jobs or something?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, I think you're absolutely correct in saying that most of the people that retire from peace officer work remain employed in some other area. I also think, just from my personal experience, that most of them do not work at full-time normal jobs, like a second career. I see a lot of them working, for example, on oil pipeline jobs, where it's either seasonal or on and off, like month on, month off, week on, week off. A lot of them do that. I can just rattle them off.
Sounds like a real job to me. Probably weren't paying better than they were making as a cop.
Representative Gatto?
Mr. Fox, you mentioned that the reason you would want to retire was that so you could spend more time with your family, your kids, et cetera, et cetera. And yet you just finished telling me that retired police officers wind up on the pipeline working certain time on, certain time off. Sounds like a conflict in the two statements.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I think I'm an exception. Most of the people that I know, they're in this kind of hyper work mode, and they keep right on working at something, at least part time. And I like my job as a trooper. I enjoyed what I was doing, and it just came down to me where I was telling my family that I can't be here for this birthday or this holiday or this event because I have to work. And I told them that for 22 years. Got to the point where I didn't have to say that anymore. I said, now I'm choosing.
Mr. Fox, I'm going to also add to that. I was just in the Judiciary Committee, and Commissioner Tandesky gave his 40-minute presentation, which I also heard in the subcommittee for public safety. And Mr. Fox was not there, but he's mentioned this. Mr. Fox has mentioned this to me several times, that there is a very difficult time occurring for law enforcement agencies all over the nation to recruit police officers. And I think that diminishes, but it's the same level almost for fire, paramedic, and for definitely for correction officers. And Commissioner Tandesky, at least to paraphrase him, stated that as we try to cut our budget, and Representative Roper's a guru at budgets, and I think he will lead our legislature in working on that, to the same extent, the commissioner said, we have to have some type of incentive, and it would be easy to target either Mr. Fox or anyone and say, well, wait a minute now. And I it's an argument, of course. We figured that there would be this argument, and it'll continue, I'm sure. You're being unfair to other groups, occupations, teachers, and the like. But I think regardless if Mr. Fox watched his children or went and made, you know, $150,000 later after he retired and put in 20 years of dedicated service, I think the bottom line is, and I think the inherent idea why they came to me and why we have the bill before you, is that they want to recruit top law enforcement officers, peace officers, and they want to keep them and not have this gap where you saw on the chart after 10 years, everyone's leaving. Obviously not just due to the COLA, but I think that that's an incentive for them to stay. Representative Roper.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you just made a statement I find kind of curious. She shortened time of allowable retirement from 25 to 20 years. How are you going to keep people longer then? I mean, that seems to be internally in conflict, logically in conflict. I can see where it might be some, as Mr. Fox mentioned, most of the peace officers that take up of their profession don't even look at the benefits until they're getting a little older after about 10 years. But he's suggesting this bill is needed because we need to improve their benefits for retirement. I mean, the testimony doesn't even warrant that because if they don't even look at retirement, how are you going to be able to use them as a recruiting pitch? Unless,
well, I understand. Let me clarify. My point is that when you recruit, let's say for a law enforcement officer, for Alaska State Trooper, and you say after 20 years when you retire, you're 22, 23, and 43, not only will there be a COLA in place where you're receiving extra benefit, but also you will have medical insurance immediately in effect, medical benefits. And, I mean, that was the intent of the bill. And my point is that that's a benefit that enhances recruitment of the best and the brightest. That's our mindset. So we're not pushing them to retire 20 years, but if they do, they have that benefit of getting receiving medical benefits immediately, not having to work another 5 years. Representative Guttenberg, and then Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fox, responding to what the Chair just said, it's my impression from my dialogue with you earlier is that, and in a lot of ways, I'm in the same situation. I started construction as a kid, never thinking I was going to retire out of it. It was a summer job. But when you get to 10 years, the likelihood of going, I mean, and you're looking at 15 more years, you would probably, the likelihood of leaving earlier is higher. Whereas if you saw it as only spending, having to spend another 10, the likelihood of spending that actual 10 is higher. That the retention is there because you don't have to go that much farther, and that you're going to walk away. You know, you're burning out, and you'll say, well, I only got 10 years. I'll stick around, but 15, I'm out of here. Is that the chair,
Representative Guttenberg? That's exactly the point. The point is that you go through a decision time. You make a decision when you go into the profession, try it on for a while, and then as you go through it, you know, and some guys are making the decision every day. When you have a tough experience, when you're having problems, you ask yourself over and over again, sometimes daily, how long can I do this? And when you get up to around 8 or 10 years, oftentimes you look down that tunnel and you say, I can't do it. I can't make it 15 years. I can make it 10, but I can't make it 15. And that's a very common decision that comes to people in the middle of their careers. And some people, I think, feel a pressure to make it then because they're in an age where if they're going to change careers, they got to get going. They've got to make the change so that they can do it in another way, because what they're leaving behind to get later that isn't much of a benefit. The first 10 years doesn't pay you very much. So if you do decide to leave, you kind of have to get going midway through that career, and that's what you see.
Representative Guttenberg and then Gatto. Did I say Guttenberg? Crawford.
I felt hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the way I see this bill, it's all about retention of highly trained individuals. And in my own work experience and going out and recruiting new iron workers and all, we have one thing that we can sell, and that's our labor. We don't have anything else that we're going to trade for economic security. This is just our labor. And when I was in my 20s, and most everybody else that I've talked to that were in their 20s, they were only concerned about how much they made on Friday, how much was on the check. Once you hit your 30s, you start getting real concerned about health benefits and retirement benefits And it becomes a much bigger factor in whether you're going to stick around or not. And I believe that this is the way that we ought to go to try to retain highly trained individuals to work in a high-stress job. It makes good sense to me.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Retired fireman Gatto.
Mr. Fox, I can tell you that after 10 years as a paramedic in Anchorage, I was done. I was fried. And there was no way I was going to work 10 more, or 15 more, or 5 more. But I had the opportunity to transfer over to the fire line where I could have lasted forever. In fact, when I finally retired, it wasn't because of burnout. It was some other things that just made it a good time with calculations. But that aside, I'm going to ask you this question. You told me that you were not ordinary, different or so. And I want to talk a little bit about the typical, if there is such a thing, or it's just a large group of people in this career who are considering retirement. And I want to see if it passes a certain test. If you hire on your job at 20 with a 20-year retirement or a 25-year retirement, I want to see what happens to that person. He works 10 years. He's now 30 years old. Is he likely to jump ship at 30 years old and say, I can't last 15? Because if he can, he's going to be 30, 45 years old after 25 years, starting at 20, and have medical and retirement and COLA, and he's only 45 years old. So my guess is that the typical person is not going to jump ship after 10 years and say, I think I'll start a new career. So we'll take an older person, especially since that person at age 30 now has the security requirements of, I need a paycheck because I have a spouse, a baby, a house, a car, go on from there. So let's take an older person. Let's say he didn't start this job at 20. He started this job at, if we can say, 40, if you would accept people at 40. And he's looking at it now, and he works 10 years. He's now 50. Is he likely to jump ship at age 50 and say, oh, man, I could work 10 more years but not 15? Or is he likely to stay? So I'm trying to take these two cases of a young person, old person, and see how it affects the retention rate. And to be honest, your argument is not convincing that you will get a better retention rate in either of those two groups. And while I truly want to believe that that would happen, I'm stuck with the evidence that simply says I cannot see it in any reasonable perspective that either of these two groups is going to jump ship, unless there's somebody right in the middle that is likely to do that. People jump ship for a variety of reasons. Way better job, sick and tired of Alaska, got divorced, got injured, which have nothing to do with looking out to whether it's 20 or 25 years. So I'm asking you to explain to me how you see that enormous difference that either 20 years or 25 years causes people in what age group to make a decision to say I don't want this job anymore because of the 5 years. That's what I need to be convinced of, and I'm really praying that you can do that for me. Convince me that that is the kind of thing that we're looking at. Can you do that?
I believe so. Through the chair, Representative Gatto, just a little change to your comments, which is you have to be 21 to be hired. And if you are 21, you're extremely young on the scale. So it's more common to be 23, 24, 25 when you come into the profession, if it is your first real job. And actually, a lot of people would argue that that's too young because you're short on life's experiences. And when you're dealing with things that peace officers deal with, thinking on your feet in crisis situations, of tragedies and homes and stuff, it's really beneficial to have a few life experiences of your own when you're dealing with the things that keep you from sleeping at night. So generally you have to ratchet up your thinking on years just a little bit. And I will just repeat something that I said earlier. When I started preparing for this and trying to figure out where it was that guys were going and when they were leaving, I talked to guys and I asked them. And I found that the people that I talked to told me, they said, I have 6 years on, I've got 7 years on, I've got 10 years on, and I don't think that I can keep coming to work in this profession for 15 more years. I don't think I can keep coming. I don't think I can come to going for 10 years under these circumstances, because the reward at the end of it is not justified. They tell me that. They say there's a, you know, you spend all this money on hiring and training a guy, and in the last person I talked to, 4 years later, only 4 years later, he says, this job is so demanding that I've changed my mind over a period of 4 years. I came into this job thinking that I could do it for 20 years. And 4 years later of working nights, working swings, away from home, dealing with disasters, crises, day in and day out, you can say these are the reasons you're leaving, but those aren't the reasons you leave. The reasons you leave is because you have to do it every day. And as you look into the future, you say, can I continue to work in this field and these group of problems day after day after day for the next 10 or 15 years? And the answer is very often, no, I cannot. So what makes a person do it? And I can guarantee you that I said many times to my wife, we need to get a dog so that when I can come home, I have something to kick. You know, my career was hardly a walk in the park. And I can tell you that when I hit 10 years, I had this tremendous feeling of it's halfway over on many, many days. You have this feeling it's halfway over. And I'll tell you what, 5 more years is a big difference. When I had 10 years on the job, I was working in Valdez. And that was 1989. And that was the year the Exxon Valdez hit the rock. And there was all of a sudden a lot of job opportunities right there in Valdez. And about a year after that, Alyeska Pipeline expanded their operations to include a bunch of environmental work, oil spill prevention and care. And they came to me and they said, we have a job to offer you. They just came to my office one day and made an appointment. They wanted to talk to me. And they said, we want you to come to work for us. And we will pay you $78,000 a year, which was about $20,000 or $30,000 more than I was making for the state. You will work week on, week off. You'll get all your medical benefits. You'll get retirement benefits. You don't have to go to Bristol Bay. You don't have to go to Bering Sea. You don't have to work away from your family. We want you to come to work. And I said, well, I'm going to think about this. This is a very nice thing. And so I asked them later, I said, well, how much time do I have? And they said, you have 2 years to decide. So that took me to eight years to go. And I went back to him, I waited several months, and I went back to him and I said, I'm going to stay with the state because I know that at the end of 8 years, I have a full retirement benefit. I'm a tier one person and I have a full retirement benefit. And I can guarantee you, I can absolutely guarantee you that if I would have had to wait 5 more years, I would have left. I am exactly a case in point in your argument. I had a perfect opportunity to do something that would be fun, that would pay well, that would offer me all kinds of challenges, and actually, in many ways, a better lifestyle. And I said no. And the reason I said no was because I could see the end of the tunnel, and I could see myself making it to the end of that tunnel. And I tell you, if it was 5 years longer, I would have said no. And that's the same question that many, many peace officers are faced with right now. They're just as qualified, they're just as well-trained, they're just as good of employees as I was. And the same opportunities are out there. And when employers are coming to them and asking them, or when they're getting bored and looking around, very often the answer is to leave. And that 5 years added on is a huge difference. And as I explained in my slide, where you see your own self, you said, how long could I last in this EMT job? I'll tell you, I was really glad when I would get to accidents and see those red lights ahead of me. I couldn't do it. I was very, very glad when there was an ambulance ahead of me. I had the utmost respect for what you did. And you were lucky, I think, in that you had a choice. Maybe you had an opportunity to leave. When you're on the floor of a jail, you don't have the choice. I hope I answered your question.
I know you're going to follow up, but I feel that Guy Bell has been here, and I want to get him in so he can get out of here. He's busy, I have no doubt, and he gets called to so many of these. And Representative Roper has a question. So, and I know you, maybe you haven't asked him all. Do you want to ask your follow-up with him, and then we'll roll on to Mr. Bell?
One more question?
Oh, please go ahead.
This is a harder one. And I don't want you to get mad at me. Don't get mad at me. I mean, I'm just poking around to get justifications here. If indeed we got a guy that's got 10 years on and doesn't like it, he doesn't, and he's looking at 10 or 15, do we want to retain a guy that doesn't like what he's doing and is going to not like it for 10 more years? Do we want to do that? I guess that's the simple question.
I'll answer that. I don't think he would stay just for the medical benefits and the extra cola. If he hated, you know. And
through the chair, I'd like to answer the question. That becomes very relative at 20. It becomes a very relative question at 20. When you have a guy that has 20 years on, do you want to say, we'll give you the rest of your benefits, but you got to stay 5 more? That is exactly the problem when you clear 20. And I've seen it, and I've seen it, and I've seen it. You end up with the worst staying because they have fewer options. The good guys have better options and they take them.
So Representative Roper?
Yeah, Mr. Fox, you're indicating that you're talking about returning 25 years to 20. Has there been a change ever? I'm not sure I follow that. You're implying that is there a national standard, or was there a standard previously, or... I'm not sure I understand that, the way the syntax in which you made those statements. Can you?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, Tier 1 employees, unfortunately you missed the first part of our presentation where I said the Tier 1 employees all receive the same benefits at normal retirement, which for all other category people is 30 years, for peace officers is 20 years. When medical benefits were restored with House Bill 242 2 years ago, benefit went back to normal retirement for all others, but it went to normal retirement plus 5 years for peace officers. So my comments in that regard are just reference the medical benefit, which was held back for 5 additional years. And I can tell you from talking to troopers, they feel that they have a 25-year retirement. That's how they see it, because that benefit is such a major part of their retirement package.
Even though, as I understand it, looking at the chart in our bill package, that they actually can retire after 20 years, but they wouldn't get the credit for the medical, and unless they were over 60, perhaps.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Very last question for you, then we'll get to Guy Bell. Heather, my staff brought up a good question, and working with you, she reminded me to ask you real briefly about retired troopers. Another aspect of retaining them is, do they not, and correction officers, do they not provide recruitment and training services to the state?
Yes, Chairman Anderson. In fact, the state contracts through House Bill 242, which allowed that, they contract troopers to do background investigations, training, many functions within public safety on a part-time basis.
And so that could be someone at 41 instead of 46. I mean, you know, in other words, at the end, they could leave and not be held hostage to stay 5 more years to get the medical benefits.
Yes, Chairman, it's very common for public safety to rehire people on contracts for specific jobs. And usually it's a month or two at a time.
I just, for the record, other staff just gave me a notice that Brian Wasserman needs to leave, and can he testify? I didn't realize he was waiting to testify. Is that someone here?
Oh, it's right here.
I didn't see that on my list here. Oh, gosh. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. And then we'll get to Mr. Bell. Brian Wasserman, are you still online?
Yes, this is Brian Wasserman. I'm in Delta Junction.
If you could, okay, you stated your name. If you could state what you do, please, for the record, and go ahead and testify.
Okay, I'm a state trooper, a sergeant out of Delta Junction. I've been a trooper for about 10 years.
Great, and do you have any comments on the bill?
I do. I just wanted to thank you guys for the opportunity to talk, and also thank you guys for hearing this bill so quickly. There have been some very intelligent questions brought up in response to this bill, and it's interesting to listen to them. And I just wanted to add that I agree with some of the comments that were made that, you know, at about the 10-year mark, I mean, I think our guys that are out in the field with 0 to 5 years on aren't thinking a whole lot about, you know, these benefits, or don't even know much about what's happening at their retirement age, that they've got to go to 25 years. But we do have a lot of troopers in the, you know, in the 5 to 10 that know about this, that are thinking, gee whiz, you know, we're, you know, we've got troopers that are going out to areas of the state, getting forced out to areas of the state that they don't really want to be in, but are going, you know, to keep this career and career going, because it's such a rewarding career and we get paid pretty well. But also it's a demanding career that that many, you know, want to get out of at 20 years after all that fun. But I just wanted to say that is, you know, it is something that a lot of the people in my, with my experience level are talking about. And it is a huge incentive for us to stay in this field and to continue on, you know, to be able to retire the 20 years without having the thought of to go 5 extra years where, you know, normally we might not want to. You know, as you know, we've got a lot of troopers working hours that the normal state employees aren't working. You know, we're working weekends, working swing shifts, grave shifts, out in remote areas of the state without the amenities that a lot of, you know, a lot of our Alaska residents have. And it is a demanding career, and I think that this is a this bill would do a lot to you know, increase the morale for these guys and you know, to stay on in this department, in this field. I've personally seen some troopers that are getting forced out to some areas of the state that they don't really want to be, you know, that are leaving this department for other careers, going to different jobs. And, you know, I think if that we added that, this incentive here would be just one more reason to, for some of our qualified troopers to stay on board and say, look, you know, it's 20-year retirement, we're getting, you know, these benefits. So anyway, I'm just in full support of this bill, and I just wanted to convey that. Thank you for this opportunity to talk.
Thank you, Sergeant Wassman. Any questions for Trooper Wassman, or Sergeant Wassman? Representative Roper has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sergeant Wassman, Wasserman, can you just tell the committee briefly about how you're, are you paid, you mentioned shift differentials and so forth. Do you have any kind of a pay incentive for shift differentials? Also, I assume you're paid overtime. Is it over 37 and a half hours per week? And is there a general norm of the amount of overtime you generally would get at a particular post or something? How does that normally work from a practical standpoint?
The first question, the shift differential, I think it's 3% for swings. If your shift starts between 12 and 8, it's 3% more. Starts after 8 p.m., I think it's 7 or 8% more than the normal salary. The overtime, it depends on what area of the state you're in. In the urban areas where there's shift coverage 24 hours a day, there's probably a little bit less overtime. You know, of course, you're always going to have guys who are coming in on days off for court and, you know, stuff that happens in the shift that needs to be taken care of. So I think in the urban posts, they're not getting as much overtime as, say, you know, some of the guys that are working in the one- and two-man, three-man posts where the shift coverage is, you know, probably for about 10 hours a day, and then for after hour calls, it's, you know, recall overtime for guys who have to take care of emergencies. You ask how much, I guess, how much overtime can we expect in a year?
Yeah, is there kind of a norm that among troopers that they kind of anticipate X amount of overtime? Or?
It varies. I would say in the summertime, you can expect to get anywhere, like I said, depending on what post you had. When I was in Nenana on the Parks Highway, I was getting anywhere from 10 to 15, 20 hours per pay period. In Fairbanks, when I was first starting out, that was, you know, maybe at the busiest time of year, I was getting lucky to get maybe 4 hours overtime per pay period for court, stuff that happened after shift.
Part of the rationale here, Sergeant, is that this bill would help the recruitment as well as retention. What's the pay range for a beginning trooper, and what range and step are you, for example, now for some 10 years?
We're in the range
76,
and I think starting salary for a recruit is Fairbanks Palmer area would be approximately $40,000 to $45,000 a year. And I'm not sure what step I'm at. I've progressed through the steps, and I'm at a post that has a cost of living increase. And my salary is approximately, I think last year I made $78,000 gross.
But that include overtime and the shift differentials and all that business, right?
Yes.
Well, thank you, Chairman.
You bet. Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you, Sergeant Wasserman. We appreciate it. We know you had to go. The other person online, and then we'll get to Mr. Bell, is Mike Curtier. Sorry if I mispronounced your name. If you could state who you are, who you're with, please.
Hello, sir. My name is Officer Michael Couturier. I'm with the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association that represents 317 sworn officers. Another 150 non-sworn employees of the Anchorage Police Department. I'm a patrol officer in the downtown area of Anchorage. I have a little over seven years on, and I'd love to first thank you, Chairman, and the members for what has happened last year, which has been an assist for us, and probably for the troopers too, I would imagine, and that is those things that happened with an improved disability retirement benefit, the improved death benefit, which was just horrendous last year, and you fixed that and moved it up to 50%, and then the first three peace officers moving down to their best 3 years instead of their best five, and we definitely wanted to thank everyone for their support in that. I agree with the sergeant. I've heard a bunch of great conversations here. Let me give you a couple of credentials before I speak further. I'm a 20-year retired Army officer that became a police officer following that retirement, so I'm one of those double dippers you're talking about. I joined the police department when I was 38, but while in the Army, I was the top recruiter in the Army at that time, during about mid-career. When that was what I was tasked with doing. Other than that, I'm an airborne ranger kind of guy. And I give you that information because I'm going to tell you a little bit about recruiting and retention from my viewpoint and the fact that I'm the one that set up the most recent recruiting program for the Anchorage Police Department, that being about 18 months ago. Officers aren't at 10 years tired of being officers. Officers at 10 years are going to stay officers. They're just going to move. And that's really, in my mind, what House Bill 91 is about. They're going to move to the lower 48. They're going to move to where the sun shines a little more often. And they're going to fly up for their salmon fishing once a year because their benefits are going to be extremely better on the West Coast, from Vancouver to Tacoma to San Diego and Stockton, California, of which most of those places have been up recruiting your officers and our officers actively. They're also, all the officers are reading Police Beat and other police rags that are distributed nationally, which the last 6, 7, 8 pages are filled with job offers for them, which if they're a certified officer, they can easily move down to those positions, go through a minimal FTO, a field training officer program, and they're on their way to better benefits, better pay, and better retirement benefits. There was a time when the troopers and the Anchorage Police Department were in the top 5, the top 10 paying agencies in the United States. Those days are gone. We're down in the 30s now, APD being somewhere around 35 or 36 in the comparable jurisdiction comparison study, and that's not good enough. It's up to our union to work on pay, benefits, and working conditions, but when it comes to retirement programs, in 1994, the municipality of Anchorage moved out of the police and fire programs, plans 1, 2, and 3, and introduced its officers to PERS. That denigrated our benefits considerably, in that was first two, tier two. And we're certainly interested in improving that benefit, definitely for recruiting and retention. The the young officers of today are not anything like the young officers of yesteryear. That, frankly, most of the people that you're speaking with reflect. The young officers of today have laptops. They have a World Wide Web. They're being bombarded with offers both online, in the rag, and by telephone, because there is a national shortage of police and fire professionals, you know, along with corrections, that this state and every other state is going to have to address. And to address that, you have to be competitive. And part of that competition, even to the youngest officers, which is new to us as a nation, frankly, they're looking past the excitement of those first one or two code three runs to an injury accident, and they are looking all the way to that 20 years and what they're going to do after that 20 years. Reference to double dipping, I don't imagine that any of us really have a problem with that. If one of our officers are willing to go through the high impact career of policing, firefighting, paramedic, or guarding a bunch of criminals as a corrections officer, then they need to be rewarded for it. And while they're being rewarded for it, the state wants to reduce its cost by maintaining those people for the full term that they're available to us, rather than training them for instance, for a police officer, it's about $100,000 to train and field a police officer for the Anchorage Police Department. Of course, we have our own academy. And we're talking about the academy, the field training, and about the first year of getting them on the street up and running. We're losing those officers. Anchorage Police Department is losing those officers to Vancouver, Portland, Stockton, San Diego, and we're losing them between 5 and 8 years in, because they're savvy enough to see that they've got their certificate from the state of Alaska, they're badge-carrying cops, and they can take that trade to the South. And they do. And they move back to where their families are at. Sometimes reluctantly, they're being drugged by their spouse, who wants to go back home because now they have children and they'd love them to know their grandparents, etc. And maybe even this benefit wouldn't help some people. But we think overall, whatever we can move to enhance the package that we offer as a police department will help. One other thing I'd like to add quickly is, we have, and I mean this in the nicest way, we have troopers coming to the Anchorage Police Department. And we have that because we're all on the same sheet of music now with PERS. And yet we're, of course, a larger city that offers some benefit to those troopers that might want not to move around, and our pay and benefits, course, aren't exactly equal. So what's happening with the troopers is not in great numbers, but in certainly significant enough numbers when you ask the troopers. They're coming to us, and frankly, we're glad to have them. They're all great officers. They come very well trained, and the training didn't cost us anything. After a couple of weeks of training in the field training officer program, they're hardworking cops for us, and we appreciate that. And I think it's important that the state take note of that. They were relatively happy as troopers, but there's some added benefits if they come to the police department. I think for the troopers, this is even more important, an improvement in PERS, than it is for Anchorage Police Department.
Hey, Michael, your testimony is great. We appreciate it. Could you wrap it up? Because we have one more person to testify, the Director of of Retirement and Benefits.
I think I didn't stop until I was done. So I appreciate the opportunity again to testify today, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
Hey, thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the committee? It looks like, I think, Sergeant and Mr. Fox probably answered a lot of those. Thanks for the supplement with your testimony, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again in future committees. So hearing no questions, then we'll go to the final person here, Guy Bell.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Michael. And thank you, Guy, for waiting so patiently. I know you're busy. I hate to send people over and then have them sit for 2 hours.
No problem at all.
He's used to it.
I'm at your disposal. I'm Guy
After
Bell.
20 years?
Yeah. I get 30. Guy Bell, Director of the Division of Retirement Benefits. Really, there has been so much testimony given, and the bill has been covered so well. I don't know that I can add much by giving additional testimony. We've submitted a fiscal note, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. I figured as much, and I appreciate that. The fiscal note was given today. This is the time to ask questions on the fiscal note. Representative Roper.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bell, I noticed the way you have this noted here, it's asterisk. Does that mean indeterminate, and then you analyze it below, or how's the format work there?
The reason we use an asterisk, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rochberg, is that the cost of a change in the retirement system is spread among the personal services line items of all state agencies. So it's not a cost to the Division of Retirement Benefits. So we put an asterisk there because it's not a cost to the division. It's money the state will need to collect and pay the retirement fund. So the cost, this $1.224 million, would be either absorbed or at least paid for by every single agency's personal services line item, because the cost of the retirement fund is largely spread among all state agencies.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I might follow up, this is GF or general fund monies then?
The last number I have, Representative Rochberg, of percentage of the budget, which is general fund, is 45%. And that was when I called OMB the other day. So 45 to 50% of the cost of personal services is GF. So roughly half of this would be GF, I'd say.
That's of the
1.224.
Yeah. What's the 13.45 million? What's that?
Well, the reason we put it this way is that you have an accrued liability and then you have a future cost. The accrued liability is effectively the increase in the system's liability as a result of absorbing this new change. Because the idea is you collect in advance for payments you make in the future.
Right.
Well, we haven't collected anything yet to pay for this. This now impacts people hired since after June 30th, 1986. So to make the system actuarially whole, we either have to increase the rate or collect $13.45 million today. And the way we run the system is that we increase the rate rather than asking for that money today. So that 13.45 million is included in that 0.18% rate.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Roper.
In the 0.18, that's the payroll increase to the agencies and in any other political subdivisions that participate in PERS, is that correct?
That's correct. Now, the rate to each political subdivision, of course, will vary to the extent that they have employee peace officers, too, because we do individualize the rates. So if a community doesn't employ any peace officers, it shouldn't affect them. Now, for instance, the municipality of Anchorage does employ police officers. You've got some very good and clear testimony about their retirement structure, and there would be an impact on that community and Fairbanks and any other community that employed police officers or firefighters.
It's now under the Tier 2 calculation that the fire and police pay 7.5% vis-a-vis all others. Is that, and then even under Tier 1, there was a premium. Is that because of the shorter period of time for retirement or to make it actuarially sound?
Historically, police officers have paid more than other employees, and I can't give you the details of the history, but I think it is because effectively because they receive benefits sooner, that the idea probably way back was the police officer rate be somewhat higher, because you do have to collect money during a shorter period of time for that benefit. So I think the rationale you presented is probably the rationale that was used when this rate was derived.
So just to clarify things, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 0.18 of payroll is from the agency itself. Is there any further contribution or on the part of the employee also? Or this is straight PERS by the agency only and not the employee?
That's correct. Now, the way that the system works, that is that
The employee rate is fixed in statute. It is set in statute at these percentages, 6.75% for a normal employee, 7.5% for a peace officer. So if there is a change in benefits, the variable, the impact is on the employer rate.
Oh, that's good. Okay. And if I might, Mr. Chairman, in the bill, and looking at your note, you don't make a distinction here between the COLA and then the other medical addition. When you made your calculations, was there any way you could break that out?
I did ask our actuary the relative weighting of the COLA versus the medical benefits, and it's weighted about two-thirds to the medical and one-third to the COLA. Now, that's pretty rough. I don't have that in writing. We employ an actuarial firm to come up with these calculations. I don't have the brains, and none of my staff do, or the black box to make these calculations. We do employ an actuary. But I did ask him that question. It's about one-third COLA, two-thirds medical.
I'm sorry. Your question, on the 1.2 million GF, you said 40% of those was what?
50% was general fund.
Oh.
1.2 million total cost, of which approximately a half would be general fund.
And the other is?
Oh, CIP receipts, federal receipts, other agency funds.
Oh, others,
funds,
federal,
receipts,
okay.
Sponsors.
All the other categories. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Well, I'm looking. Somebody else has. Right. Go on, please. Go on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know the average age of troopers and firemen, everybody covered under, I mean, not the average age, but the age where they come into the program? I mean, is it 20 or 25 or 30?
We could, Representative Gutenberg, we could probably get that for you. I think the average age of retirement for the typical peace officer now is around 52 to 53. And but the average age at entry, I would need to see if I can find that. We could probably get that information. I think you might find that they might be slightly different if you're looking at a trooper versus a correctional officer. I think there may be some different. So you, it depends on how you wanted to break those categories out.
And looking at the 1.2 million, you know, if you take about 50% of that, it's about 600,000. And I wonder if there's a value you could put on the increased retention rate on passing a bill like this and having people stay instead of leaving at 15 years, stay 20 years, and the value of not having to train or having trained more officers. I wonder if that would make up for that difference or less or more. I mean, you don't do that side of the equation, but you know, if we knew the projection, how many more people would be staying until it's the full 20 years, and then we could see the number of people, you know, savings of having retained them, whether that's offsetting on this number. I'm just talking. I'm not asking you for the question, but I think that would be an interesting value.
Representative Gatto?
Mr. Chair, it got my attention too that. And your argument that it saves money in training, but then everybody's being paid at a higher rate since they're not being trained but retained. So there has to be some sort of a number that says this is cheaper or more expensive if we could just dig it out. And I think that may be a big task. So we're going to take some guesses that one offsets the other. It's not a wash, but I'm not sure which way it goes, to be honest.
Is that a comment?
I think we're talking at you.
Yeah. Well, I guess the answer is, do you know the answer? And, you know, without asking, I'm pretty sure that's just rhetorical, and I don't think you do.
I think Mr. Fox did a fine job of answering that question, and I don't think I could add more than he did.
Representative Crawford?
I just wanted to, thank you, Mr. Chairman, wanted to make a comment. We did hear in the testimony that it was $100,000 to train a trooper. You don't have to lose too many of them before you use up that $600,000 a year and retirement benefits.
Representative Roper?
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bell, I was asked Mr. Fox about the COLA provision here. Was I correct in assuming that the public policy, from your best recollections, was to provide COLAs to older people who, in fact, would be actually retiring vis-a-vis other younger retirees? Or is there? Do you have any knowledge or history of the policy of that?
That was a compelling argument you had. The only thing I can tell you is either the statutory history, the legal history. The up until June 30th, 1986, anyone who was hired to that point was eligible for the COLA at retirement, and regardless of their age. And then with Tier 2, after June 30th, 1986, that change was made to 65. Now, I assume there probably was some rationale. Well, when does somebody really need that money? When, you know, at what point do people really stop working? I think the other side of it was just there was some interest in trying to save some cost. They were looking at ways of reducing the cost of the retirement system, and this was one of the ways they saw through to save money.
If I could, just some generic questions. Mr. Bell, given the state of the market and the investment climate in the last 3.5 years, how is the safety and actuarial soundness of our of PERS and TERS and so forth? How are we doing?
Representative Roper, we've been studying that quite a bit. And we actually because of the decline in market value of our funds, because like every other public pension fund in the country, we've suffered pretty serious declines in value. We had an actuarial audit performed to make sure that we were doing things right, to make sure we were costing things appropriately. We had an analysis done of our investment return assumption to see if it was reasonable. And so we feel good about the methods we're using. The system really is in good shape. It's with, you know, I think that if you were to have an actuary here, they would say we've done all the right things, but we were in a wrong market. And the upshot of it is that the next time an evaluation is presented to the retirement boards, and the process is that the board set assumptions. Our actuary takes those assumptions and looks at our data and produces asset liability modeling, presents a expected contribution rate employers would be required to pay 2 years hence. So the rate they'd be setting now is for fiscal year 05. And the boards take that, the retirement boards individually take that, and then they come up with a rate that will be the employer rate. And they will be hearing from our actuaries in March and in April. And probably in April, our boards will set an employer rate for fiscal year 05, so the year beginning July 1st, 2004. Under our law as it stands right now, the largest increase that could occur would be 5% in any 1 year. So let's say the state's rate is roughly on average about 7.1% right now. The greatest increase would be up to, let's say, 12.1%. Now that's a pretty hefty chunk of money, though. Whether the boards will do that, I don't know. But there is going to be a decline in the relative funded status of the system. It's going to be, we are unusual because part of our system, we have a pension benefit and we have a medical benefit. Both of them we pre-fund through our valuation process. We are the only state retirement system in the country that pre-funds our medical benefit. It's a prudent thing to do because it is a liability that we have. Without the medical benefit, we will be over 100% funded in PERS. Including the medical benefit liability, we will be below 100% in PERS. We just don't know how far below 100% we'll be funded. 100% means if we shut the program down today, we could pay 100% of all benefits that have been accrued to date. And that's where you want to be at any time. But when you take into account the medical liability, we will not be there with the next valuation. But how far below that we'll be, I just can't tell you yet. It could be fairly substantially below. But then the idea is if you're below that, you try to get to that point in 25 years. We use very long time horizons in this business because markets can change. You don't want to make sudden knee-jerk reactions to short-term volatility. So the idea will be to come up with some prudent strategy to address a shortfall in the system over a period of 25 years.
Mr. Fox had asked you, somewhat tied in with Mr. Representative Roper's question, he didn't ask, he testified that he thought this was the only state employee group of employees who did not receive medical benefits upon normal retirement. Are there any other groups that don't receive medical benefits the minute they retire?
Well, the House Bill 242, which passed, made some improvements to the medical benefit, but it did indicate that still at normal retirement, a peace officer will not get medical. They have to stay to 25. That also applies to teachers. So the other group that this would apply to would be Alaska teachers. And they're not necessarily, there are some state employees who are teachers, but most of them are not state employees.
And we're running out of time, but just real quick, I was kind of listening to Mr. Fox testify about the mission of PERS, and I guess I just want to hear on record for you to reiterate what the purpose is to offer a COLA or a medical benefit. I mean, isn't it, I'm waiting for you to say to recruit, to retain.
To attract and retain. I think it's very clear in our statute to attract and retain qualified public employees.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bell, communicate the next cycle for adjustments is the 05 budget. What did they do for the 04 budget coming up? Looking backwards, where we still had some deterioration in the markets of when they made the decision. So.
Representative Rookberg, we were still riding on a surplus that we had built up over the good times. So there was a very small increase in retirement system rates from FY03 to FY04, just a tiny ratchet up. I can get you the numbers. I don't have the specifics, but it was less than a 0.5% increase overall for the state.
Without holding you to it, to the chair, Mr. Bell, do you have any feeling at this juncture about the 05 where we are going to get a serious increase?
It's really up to the retirement boards. That's their duty.
From a crystal ball standpoint, I mean, like you said, we had a very small one because of the surplus, which has been burned through, I take it. Now we have a small one. Then are you anticipating a slightly larger one here upcoming? Or?
If I were a guessing person, I would say anything from a 0% increase to a 5% increase, more likely to be toward the 5%, at least in terms of the discussion part.
And if that were the case, I mean, that would be some pretty serious ramifications for the general fund expenditures, wouldn't it?
I can get those numbers, but if you're looking at a $680 million personal services budget, and 5% of that is roughly $30 million, and half of that is GF, you're talking about a $15 million, if my math is
right, which actually which is a significant amount of money, and and it's ongoing until it's adjusted. You know. And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bell, your knowledge of pension benefits and so forth, isn't corporate America right now facing an enormous issue because of the shortfall in market performance to be able to meet their obligations under their pension programs? Many corporations and companies that have pension benefits are looking at having to draw down on retained earnings or cash flows to fund those. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's been in the press, and some companies have filed for bankruptcy and are closing their pension plans. And under ERISA, there are some protections because there are some protections for private pension plans. But definitely, there are some pretty negative, heavy negative consequences going on in corporate America because of the decline in markets.